Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for this morning will be Archer Daniels Midland Company against Regis Payardon.
Thank you, Chief Judge Wood. Canon Shanmugam of Williams & Connolly for the ADM appellants. May it please the Court, the Federal Arbitration Act permits judicial review of arbitral awards in certain concededly narrow circumstances. In particular, it is well established that where the arbitrator's award does not draw its essence from the party's agreement, the arbitrator thereby exceeds his powers for purposes of the FAA.
Now, of course, that language comes from labor arbitration cases, which come out of a quite particular context. And I'm interested in hearing you talk a little bit about why you think Section 10 of Chapter 1 of the Federal Arbitration Act applies to this New York Convention-governed arbitration.
Sure. Well, first of all, just to be clear, this Court has indicated that if you are operating under Chapter 1 of the FAA, the analysis for determining whether or not the arbitrator's award draws its essence from the party's agreement is essentially the same as the standard in the labor context.
We've said I'm concerned about context there, because in the labor cases we've stressed the industrial context of a case, the arbitrator's familiarity with collective bargaining agreements and the like, and international commercial arbitration is quite a different creature. But I think rather than get distracted with that, if you could look at the question whether Section 10 has anything to do with the New York Convention case, especially in light of more recent Supreme Court decisions such as Hall Street.
Sure. Well, let me say two things, Chief Judge Wood. First, with regard to this question about Section 10 vis-a-vis labor awards, I think it's quite clear that really ever since the Steelworkers trilogy, courts determining whether or not an arbitrator has exceeded his powers have looked to whether the award draws its essence from the underlying agreement. And notably, in the Court's most recent pronouncement on the meaning of Section 10, the Oxford Health case, Justice Kagan, in her opinion for the Court, essentially substituted the word economic in the phrase about whether the arbitrator was applying his view of industrial justice.
Right. And so by the way, I'm not sure that that's going to help you very much, but it is one has to make something out of Section 10's language about so far exceeded their powers as to go beyond. I mean, I'm a believer in going back to the statutory language and not a lot of glosses.
Right. And so let me get to the second part of your question, Chief Judge Wood, with regard to the New York Convention.
Since we have a split in the circuits, as you've conceded.
We do. And we think that the better view is that on a motion to vacate, a court retains the ability to apply local law, that is to say United States law, even with regard to an award that is governed by the New York Convention.
And where do you find this in the New York Convention? I can't find any language that distinguishes vacator from other actions, although the only thing there is that you've seized on is the language in the New York Convention that acknowledges that if the court of the situs of the arbitration has set aside an award, there's a certain preclusive effect of that. But I think that's quite different from saying that you just chuck the New York Convention and go straight back to Chapter 1 whenever you want to.
Well, 2 points, Chief Judge Wood. First, we rely on the language of Chapter 2 of the FAA, and Section 207 of Title IX provides only that in a proceeding to confirm an award, the grounds set out in the convention are exclusive. Second, we do rely on the language in the New York Convention.
But there's a policy in favor. I mean, the Supreme Court has lectured us incessantly. There's a policy in favor of arbitration. So I would be very surprised if I were to read 207 to say we can vacate whenever we want to, but we have to observe the convention limitations when we're confirming. Seems quite inconsistent to me with the deference we owe to arbitration.
Well, 2 points once again, Chief Judge Wood. First, Section 208 says that in all other respects, the other provisions of the FAA apply unless there is a conflict. And so we certainly draw from that, in conjunction with Section 207, the conclusion that on a motion to vacate, those grounds in Chapter 1 of the FAA remain available. And second,
what do you
do
with Article 5 of the New York Convention, which says recognition and enforcement may be refused only if these five things are satisfied, and then there are two other discretionary grounds in Part 2 of Article 5?
We rely on Article 5, Section 1, Subsection E, which provides, and I'm quoting, that recognition and enforcement of the award may be refused if the award has been set aside or suspended by a competent authority of the country in which or under the law of which that award was made. And that provision simply codifies the principle, which I think is widely accepted, that when an award is made under the New York Convention, there is a distinction between courts with primary jurisdiction and courts with secondary jurisdiction. Courts with primary jurisdiction are courts inter alia in the jurisdictions in which the award is made.
But and there is no competent court that has set aside or suspended this arbitration award.
Well, that is, of course, what we were asking the district court to do.
It didn't happen, you know, and so I guess I'm just saying there's a power to set aside, but this language doesn't tell you the grounds on which something might be set aside. So if, for example, the court in the United States were to find that Article 5.1b was met and there wasn't proper notice, then perhaps that U.S. court would set aside the arbitration award, all inside the umbrella of the New York Convention. So you're adding to this language to say that the grounds on which it might be set aside or suspended are not limited by the New York Convention. I don't see that there.
I take your point, Chief Judge Wood, but I think that that language really has been understood to embody the principle that courts in the primary jurisdiction do retain the authority to apply local law. And again, we think
that was understood before the Supreme Court's Hall Street case, before other cases. I think you're relying on the old line of cases launched by the Second Circuit, and I'm not sure that they are reflective of what the court is now doing.
Well, I don't think that Hall Street and the subsequent Supreme Court FAA cases speak to this precise question, which is the question of whether, however broad the grounds are in Chapter 1 of the FAA, and I take your point that the Supreme Court has narrowed those grounds in certain respects, albeit respects that aren't really relevant here. But I think that there's a separate question as to whether the New York Convention allows a party to rely on those grounds when they are not the grounds set out in the convention. And again, the view of the vast majority of the circuits to consider that issue is that, yes, it does, precisely because of this distinction between what courts with primary jurisdiction can do and what courts with secondary jurisdiction can do. Because after all, if the view that you're suggesting were the correct view, that distinction would really cease to have any real meaning.
I'm not sure it would. I mean, I think that it just gives you a res judicata. But I'm interested also in moving beyond this, because even if you're correct, and even if we were to follow the majority of the circuits, I have a great deal of trouble seeing this case as anything but the second bite at the apple that we criticized most recently in the Johnson Controls case.
Yes, and let me explain, Chief Judge Wood, why that's not true and why this is, frankly, a somewhat unusual case. First of all, let me sort of just set on the table what I think the parties actually agree on here, because I think it's very important to understand those premises here. I think there are really sort of three critical propositions that I do not hear my friend Mr. Ullman to be disputing. The first is that the only valid basis for the arbitrator's determination that ADM had breached the agreement was ADM's unilateral termination of the agreement and not its decision to stop doing business.
But yes, you have seized on that sentence in the arbitrator's opinion, I think, in a way that's actually quite extreme, I guess. The arbitrator says you violated by unilaterally terminating. You needed everybody's agreement to terminate. You didn't have it. You just terminated. That's what he says.
And we can see that that would be a valid basis for that determination.
And
we certainly
a basis for his determination.
Yeah, and we don't.
Doesn't he determine that Venezuela law requires a mutuality in termination? Doesn't he make that finding at some point?
Yes, but I think that the critical point, Judge Tinder, for present purposes, is that when he went on to say in that critical paragraph that ADM had also breached by stopping the performance of the business. And this, I realize that my friend says, well, this is a single sentence in a single paragraph of the award. But this is really the critical paragraph in the section of the award that sets out the grounds for the determination of a breach.
But and you, again, would you concede at least that we have to read that sentence in some way? I mean, I'm not sure it can be read your way, but suppose it could. Then that would just say maybe there are a couple of possible readings, and we need to decide what was the arbitrator saying in light of his opinion.
Well, let me explain why I think that that sentence is really important here. Because really,
that's the only way you can win.
Well, then I really should explain why
yes,
it's important.
But
here's why the question of what the arbitrator determined what the breach was is so significant here. We believe that if the only valid basis for a breach was our unilateral termination of the joint venture, then the relevant inquiry for purposes of awarding damages is whether, but for the unilateral termination of the joint venture, we, ADM, would have continued doing business with Mr. Pyodon. And I would note that
the fact determination by the arbitrator, which may be right and which may be wrong, but we don't get that granular, that, in fact, business, which had been a very lucrative business, would have continued.
The arbitrator, with respect, Chief Judge Wood, did not determine that. The closest that the arbitrator came to making that determination was to determine that if ADM had continued doing business with Mr. Pyodon, there is no support for the proposition that we would have stopped all transactions that involve brokers. But that determination is premised on the assumption that we would have continued doing business in the first place.
And if we were go ahead.
And didn't ADM's business in Venezuela collapse after the termination? They stopped doing business there.
Well, we had a very hard time continuing to do business, but in our view, that just But in our view, that just reinforces the proposition which Pyodon concedes at page 17 of his brief, that we unilaterally terminated the joint venture precisely because we no longer wanted to do business with him. In fact, we so strongly no longer wanted to do business with him that we were willing to incur the cost of losing all of the profits that we would have obtained from an ongoing operation in Venezuela. And I think that that is really the critical point here. If the arbitrator had in fact found in hic verba that but for the unilateral termination, we would have continued doing business, obviously, Chief Judge Wood, at that point, we would be unable to obtain review, even if we could point to, as we could, a mountain of evidence suggesting that the precise reason that we terminated was that we no longer wanted to have anything to do with Mr. Pyodon.
Does an arbitrator need to make a finding on every point, on every nuance of, that leads to the result?
No. As a procedural matter, the only obligation that the arbitrator had here was to produce a reasoned award. But courts of appeals, including this court in the Young Radiator decision, an opinion I would note parenthetically, it was written by Judge Flom, noted that where an arbitrator, and I'm quoting, has failed to rule on the issue upon which resolution of the party's dispute should depend, at a minimum, the challenging party is entitled to a remand to the arbitrator for that determination. And we would certainly suggest that given the centrality of that inquiry here, that a remand at a minimum would be appropriate. And I would just note that the reason why this really matters, and the reason why this falls within the narrow category of cases in which this court has vacated arbitral awards, is that if the arbitrator did not engage in that determination, and we think that there are affirmative indications in the award that the arbitrator, in fact, did not do so, he would have awarded damages that were essentially punitive. He would no longer have awarded damages.
He didn't do that, though. He's well aware of the difference in Venezuelan law between what they like to call moral damages. He says the claim of moral damages is dismissed, paragraph 6.5.6. He looks at the expert testimony on both sides. If we were reviewing de novo, a lot of things you're saying might make sense.
Yeah, I would like to reserve at least 1 minute for rebuttal. But let me just say one thing. Thank you, Chief Judge Wood. Let me just say one thing in response to that. I think that there are sort of two paths here. If the arbitrator had engaged in the correct inquiry, I think we all agree that the award should be sustained. We don't think there's a finding. We think there are affirmative reasons to think that the arbitrator did not engage in that inquiry because of what he said constituted the breach here. And I think Mr. Pyridon would concede that if the arbitrator did not make that determination at all, it would result in a damages award that is not permitted under the party's agreement. And those are precisely the types of awards that this court has vacated. Thank you, and I would like to reserve a minute.
I'll let you have your minute. Mr. Ullman. So do you concede that, Mr. Ullman?
I confess I didn't exactly catch what he said because I was getting ready to stand up.
We'll let you proceed.
I'm sure I don't, because I don't agree with anything that he says in terms of what the arbitrator did.
Okay.
Your Honors, there's no question, as my opponent concedes, that the review of arbitration awards is extremely narrow. As we've pointed out, we believe the court would be justified in concluding that the grounds for the convention apply exclusively, but we think that ADM has fallen so far short of its burden under the FAA in exceeding the powers, we don't think the court really needs to reach that. Under the FAA, Section 10A4, which is the sole provision that ADM relies on, an arbitration award has to be confirmed so long as the arbitrator is even arguably applying the contract, irrespective of whether the arbitrator's decision is, in the view of the court, right, wrong, clearly wrong, grossly wrong, or even wacky. Now, in this case, ADM has argued that the arbitrator exceeded his powers as to both liability and damages, and I'll address both of those briefly.
Yeah, if you can start on liability, maybe you'd like to say a word about this stopping the performance argument, since there is some language in the underlying joint venture agreement that seems to leave the amount of business ADM does with the joint venture up to ADM.
Sure. Well, the stopping of ADM's argument is that the arbitrator exceeded his powers by finding liability based on stopping the performance of the business. So they've seized on seven words from Section 6.7.9 of the award, in which the arbitrator stated that he finds that ADM breached the JVA by unilaterally terminating and stopping the performance of the business. The seven words out of the entire opinion, and they contend that the seven words stopping the performance of the business somehow constituted a finding of an independent and separate breach, totally separate from the unilateral termination, and that, they say, was an excess of powers on liability. Now, first of all, ADM abandoned that argument below before Judge McCuskey. When they made it,
Judge McCuskey talk about it?
No, he doesn't specifically mention it. We cited the ADM papers before Judge McCuskey, in which, following our response to their opening, we explained why we thought this argument had no merit. They came back and said to Judge McCuskey, basically, we're not going to press this argument. We're not going to resuscitate it. That was
their first. That hardly seems like an abandonment to me. It's just sort of a style of getting to.
Well, we think it's abandonment, Your Honor, because they then went on to say, so all you need to do, Judge McCuskey, is consider the issue of damages. They basically told him in hyperbole, you don't need to think about this argument anymore. But independent of that, the only way they can prevail on that argument, because at most the language they rely on has some ambiguity to it, the only way they can prevail is if they can show that their purported interpretation is the only reasonable interpretation of that language. And we don't believe that they can come anywhere near close to meeting that, because as we've set out at pages 32 to 41 of our brief, there are other interpretations that are both reasonable and clearly contractually based, one of which is that the arbitrator was simply describing what happened when the unilateral termination took place, which is consonant with what he wrote in Section 6.4.12 of the agreement when he said Mr. Jansen told Pyridon of the unilateral termination and contemporaneously they stopped performing. So we think he was just giving descriptive language as to what was going on.
So you just read this 6.7.9 as saying once it's terminated, of course, it wasn't going to continue.
I believe that's what he was saying. Or alternatively, he was pointing out that as part of the unilateral termination for the breach to occur, they had to stop performing. Obviously, I don't think you can have a unilateral termination if performance continues. But either way, there's nothing in the language itself that suggests that he was finding an independent breach. And as we pointed out in our papers, We don't believe their argument can reasonably be the correct one or even a plausible one in this context. First of all, if they had if the arbitrator had wanted to say that there are two independent breaches, and I know my opponent in his argument said the arbitrator found that ADM had also breached by stopping the performance of the business. That's not what the arbitrator said. He didn't say they also breached. He said they breached by unilaterally terminating and stopping the performance. If he had wanted to make it clear that there was something separate going on, for example, he would have used the parallel by construction.
Well, he might have. I mean, although people don't always realize, I say this with years of experience under my belt, how somebody else is going to read what you said several years down the line. So he may have meant one thing, he may have meant another. I want to know, though, really in the broader sense, and this actually goes to the damages question as well, what your understanding of the non-exclusivity aspect of this joint venture arrangement is. I mean, what was the obligation to deal between the parties?
Okay. We acknowledge that under the joint venture agreement, ADM was not required to make any particular sale. The Regis Pierdon, the people who worked with him in Venezuela, would make the local contacts and get a deal that they thought was a good one and put it up to ADM. And ADM had the power to say, no, we don't want to do that deal. We don't want to make those sales.
So that you agree is a sale by sale basis.
Yes.
It's not we'll deal in soybeans, but we won't deal in corn.
No. They had the power, and in fact, for a period of time, they said we don't want to make any sales while we're investigating what's going on, and we never claimed that was a breach. Mm-hmm. Okay. As far as exclusivity, whether ADM was able to sell if it wanted to sell outside the joint venture, that was an issue before the arbitrator that he never decided. We argued that they did have exclusivity. ADM argued that they didn't. The arbitrator said basically he sees no reason to reach that issue, and he never
does. Did ADM, in fact, in the course of these dealings, did ADM have any sales outside of the joint venture?
In the evidence showed, Your Honor, that they did not with respect to the products that were sold by the joint venture, with, I believe, the exception of two sales of Canadian wheat that took place, I don't remember when, and never happened again. And there was one other instance where it happened. Pierdon went to ADM and said, hey, what's going on here? That's supposed to come through us. Again, these were for products that the joint venture was selling, and it never happened again. So the evidence clearly showed that in practice, whether or not ADM agreed with the concept of exclusivity, that's how the business had been operated.
Did the arbitrator find that there was a course of dealing that made this, in fact, an exclusive
relationship? No, he didn't. He said he didn't need to reach that issue because he never did. He said the parties have argued it, but I don't have to reach it.
So does he kick this over then to damages? Because I can understand at the breach level, if he thinks that the breach is the unilateral termination,
mm-hmm.
and let's read that paragraph your way for the moment, unilateral termination with the predictable consequence that performance was stopped, then you would need to say, well, what are the damages from the breach? And here we had a couple of experts, right? You both had some experts talking about how much predictable business would have been done over a fairly long period of time, a 10-year period of time. I was a little surprised to see that.
Yes, Your Honor. No one contested the 10-year damages period. And first of all,
no one contested 10 years.
The other side accepted the 10 years damages period. I understand what you're asking is what essentially was the arbitrator, was there evidence before the arbitrator to uphold the award? First of all, the question of the sufficiency of the evidence, Your Honor, under the clear law of this circuit, is that is not something that's subject to judicial review. That's stated in the Elger case, the Genghis International case, the flexible manufacturing case, and other cases where I think the phrase is that a claim of insufficiency of the evidence doesn't trigger judicial review. But putting that aside, in this case, we think the answer is clear. Yes, there was. The arbitrator specifically said in Section 6.9 of his opinion that he understands and he's applying the Venezuelan law of damages for lost profits, which say you have to assess the lost income stream that Pierdon would have enjoyed but for the unilateral termination. And he says in Section 6.7.8 of his opinion, I'm going to now go and assess the actual damages calculations in Section 8. And in Section 8, that's exactly what he did. He reviews the competing damages projections from both sides' experts. He looks at what our expert put in. He looks at what the other side said was wrong with it, makes his assessments. And in the course of that, he further specifically states that ADM was going to continue to perform if the unilateral termination had not taken place.
So now, would you remind me how long this relationship actually operated? There are some fairly big numbers about what the value of the business relationship was during the time it was operating.
Well, it had operated for 10 years, since 1999. In terms of gross revenues, I know the total gross revenues had been in the billions of dollars for the 10-year period. So this was very big business. I think the testimony was that they averaged several hundred million dollars worth of business a year. That translated, obviously, into a lower number for profits. And my recollection is that 2009 was the most profitable year, and the gross profit for both partners, I think, was something on the order of $18 to $20 million, and that was supposed to be split between ADM and its local partners.
I'm just trying to put that $34 million in some kind of context.
Now, I'm aware of their argument, of course, which is what their argument hinges on, that under the contract, ADM had discretion not to make any sales. That's the linchpin of their argument. That's the same argument they made to the arbitrator. Okay? And as Judge McCuskey found and the arbitrator found, the existence of discretion doesn't speak to how the discretion would be exercised. Okay? And in this case, the arbitrator heard ADM's arguments that it didn't have to make any further sales. He heard the evidence. He drew his inferences, and he rejected their argument, and he found that if the unilateral termination hadn't taken place in the contract, the JVA had remained in force, ADM would have continued to perform. And while we don't think this is a subject for judicial review, that conclusion we believe was amply supported by the evidence. For example, the testimony of the ADM witnesses was that right up to the time of the unilateral termination, they had not found any evidence of any improper payments to brokers, which is what they said, caused them to have concerns in the first place, or any payments that even seemed suspicious, and nothing was brought out in the hearing. The evidence showed, and the arbitrator found, that the unilateral termination was done without cause, meaning that ADM had no substantive reason to terminate the contract. Also, the testimony of the ADM witnesses uniformly was that right up to the time of the unilateral termination, they wanted to continue to do business with Pyrdon and had no plans to change the way they were going to do business with him in the future, which is understandable because the business had been so successful and had been operating for such a long period of time. Now, conversely, there was no evidence from any ADM witness that if the unilateral termination had not taken place and the contract had remained in force, that ADM would have nonetheless, quote, exercised discretion and refused to make a single sale going forward. Now, ADM says that this point shouldn't be considered relevant because it says Pyrdon had the burden of proof. But the arbitrator was clearly entitled to take into account all the evidence before him, and conduct from which an inference can be drawn is itself evidence. And when a witness who would be expected to speak if he had something to say, remain silent, that's something that supports an evidence or an inference. And in this case, although the ADM witnesses had full opportunity to do so, not a single one of them testified that if the contract had remained in force, if they had remained contractually bound with Pyrdon and the JVA continued, they nonetheless would never have made a single sale in the future. That evidence, that testimony didn't exist. And finally, there's the evidence of ADM's own damages expert, Mr. Hart. He put in counter projections on damages, and he put in two scenarios. They're what he called an exclusive scenario and a non-exclusive one. In both of them, he showed ADM continuing to perform into the future. Mr. Hart told the arbitrator he thought these were more accurate projections that should be used by the arbitrator in the event the arbitrator determined that some breach, a breach, not a tort, as ADM is now trying to spin it, but a breach were found that the arbitrator concluded resulted in damages to Pyrdon. And in Mr. Hart's exclusive scenario, he showed ADM continuing to perform for the full 10-year damages period. Now, while ADM on this appeal is trying to walk away from the evidence of Mr. Hart was ADM's own damages witness, and he was putting on ADM's damages case. So while we believe that insufficiency of the evidence is not a ground for judicial review, we believe in this case the arbitrator's decision was fully and sufficiently supported by the evidence of record. And finally, Your Honors, as the Court may recall, we've made a motion for sanctions in this case. We respectfully submit that ADM's appeal was objectively groundless and essentially preordained under the law of this circuit as well as the law of the Supreme Court to fail. Making a motion for sanctions is not something that we or Pyrdon does lightly. But in this case, Your Honor, all they have done is drag out the proceedings for an additional 6 months. They have failed to heed the warnings of this court, guarding a warning against precisely this conduct, and we respectfully submit that sanctions be imposed here. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. So you have a minute, Mr. Shanmugam.
Great, thank you. Well, just a couple of very quick points, and may it please the Court. First of all, I think it's important to realize that the joint venture agreement here did nothing more than essentially establish ADM de Venezuela as the mechanism through which the parties could do business. And in the very preamble to the joint venture agreement, the parties made clear that the agreement itself was a non-exclusive one.
But, you know, that just makes it a little bit like employment at will, it seems to me. And we have a long line of cases that say even though you could terminate at any time, it doesn't mean there can't be a contract under which enforceable obligations.
Right. My point is simply that this was not a requirements contract or any a contract
right.
that imposed any sort of substantive obligations. And that leads to my second point, which is an important factual point that I think is a little bit lost in the discussion here. And that is that at the time of the unilateral termination, ADM had already stopped doing business with Mr. Pyrdon. This is page 44 of the appendix, where the arbitrator himself notes that as of early May 2009, ADM had essentially frozen the operations of the joint venture. So ADM had already made the decision to stop doing business. And third, the unrebutted evidence showed, and Pyrdon actually concedes, that we unilaterally terminated precisely because we wanted nothing more to do with him. Now, he argues that the reason we did that was to keep the profits for ourselves, but whatever our motivation was, I think it could not be clearer that we wanted to stop doing business. And given the absence of a finding by the arbitrator on that specific issue, we think that there should be reversal or remand. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both sides. We will take the case under advisement.